views expressed in this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of 94.9 CHRW.
We are all in this together, brothers and sisters. We can do better. Raise your voices to the sky. The price of silence is much too high.
Welcome to the new show called Between the Margins on CHRW. My name is Michelle Boyce, and my co-host Gio Lakey is here, and we have in studio guest Jeff Preston. For those of you that were expecting F words today, we have now started swapping shows between Ashley's F words and our show, so every other week you will see our show or theirs. So.
And a jackhammer.
And a jackhammer coming through the mics, probably.
Well, for those of you who are wondering what Between the Margins is, we are essentially
a show about human rights and the pursuit of people's happily ever after.
I could add something corny in here and say that it's something about being all on the same page, but it's a little too early for that. Need a couple of cups of coffee to get into that. Sorry, we seem to be having a little technical difficulty at the moment.
Oh.
Expected with new shows, I imagine. So we might as well just jump right in here. And we have a wonderful guest in studio with us today to touch on our topic, accessibility. And this is Jeff Preston. He's a PhD student here at UWO. And he's also the star of the documentary, Idling a Transic Story. Nice to meet you, Jeff.
No, thanks for having me in today.
We had a little clip queued up for your idling intro. We'll see if we can get that going here.
I want to tell you a story, one that too often goes untold, but involves countless in our community, a story about transportation. Thousands of disabled across Ontario are left stranded every day because of the lack of accessible transportation. Buses aren't fully accessible, specialized systems don't work, and few accessible cabs are to be found. And while there are many explanations as to why these problems exist, this story isn't about that. This story is our story. The story of how so many people are left sitting by the curb, waiting for a ride that may never arrive. This is the story of one man who said never again, starting a mission to drive his wheelchair over 650 kilometers to call for justice, dignity, and above all, equality. This is the story of the Mobilize March.
So, Jeff, tell us a little bit about this trailer that we just heard. How did you come up with the music and
all of it? Well, maybe we'll talk a little bit about the genesis of the project and as a good introduction. So, idling really started about a year ago now, when I had just finished my trip to Ottawa entitled the Mobilize March, where I drove my electric wheelchair from London to Ottawa to raise awareness about the lack of transportation across the province, not just in London, but across the province. And I decided that I had all this footage from my trip, that we were very diligent in videotaping everything that we did, from the drives to the social times in between to the speeches, all of it. And I decided it would be really interesting to be able to put this all together into some form of movie, a documentary, to show people about my trip, but also to continue to educate on accessible transportation. So I thought this would be an opportunity to continue the momentum that was gained along the way to Ottawa. So I put it together and I decided to launch it online. I wanted to do a live premiere of some sort, like a real movie. My concern was I didn't know how people with disabilities would be able to get to the premiere to see it. So I thought, what better way than to host it on streaming YouTube and allow people to see it from their own homes at their own pace, so that they're able to digest the information and get educated on the issues.
Wonderful.
Well, I certainly sat down and plugged through the 6 episodes, and I found it actually really interesting. And I suppose the question begs to be asked, what made you wake up one morning and say, hey, I think I'd like to drive my wheelchair from London to Ottawa?
Well, I think temporary insanity might be one of the explanations to that. It started out as a bit of a joke where some friends and I were chatting, and we were saying, if you had to get somewhere urgently, if you had to get somewhere, how would you do it if you were in a wheelchair? You know, if you had to get to Ottawa and you couldn't be late, how could you do it reliably? And I said, you know, you got airlines that consistently lose your wheelchairs or break your wheelchairs. You have trains that only have one spot for a wheelchair in each car, in each physical train, not even each car, but each train has one spot for an electric wheelchair. And you have buses that are extremely long. You have to book in advance. Ultimately, there is no good way. And one of my friends said, well, you could always drive yourself. You have a wheelchair. Like, you can do it yourself. And we sort of had a laugh. And, you know, the next day I woke up and I started thinking about it. And I said, you know, it might actually be possible. It might be possible to drive a wheelchair. And so I started looking into it. And we figured out a way. We mapped it all out. We figured out the mathematics of it all in terms of battery life and energy of my own. And I said, you know what? This does look feasible. This does look possible. And what better way to show the insanity of accessible transportation in Ontario than to live it, than to cross this province in my wheelchair to show that, you know, this is the only way to do it. This is the only way to get it done. And I think there's no better visual from the entire trip than when I'm pulling into Ottawa with the rain beating down, just drenched, and knowing that there was no other way to have made that happen. There would be no other way for me to reliably get to City Hall in Ottawa on a specific date.
Oh, wow. Well, I know the trip takes me about 6-7 hours. I'm actually from the Ottawa area. On a good day, how long actually did it take you to make the trek?
The entire trip was 47 days, 15 of which were driving days. I would alternate based on energy and meetings and things like that. But it was 15 days of physically hitting the pavement and driving. And the rest of the time was spent working in the communities, working with municipal government, provincial government, and community groups in the area to try and develop accessibility transit in those communities, try and share this information to try and get people moving.
I see. And generally, what was the response from the communities that you stopped in? Were they generally positively received? Were they?
Yeah, it was. The response was fantastic. The amount of support we got across the province was unbelievable, both from our sponsors and also from people. We had people stopping us as we were on our way. People would flag us down and want to stop and say hi and say, you know, we saw you on the news and we really wanted to meet you, so we waited for you on your path to say hi. And we had a lot of people meet us when we arrived in Ottawa as well to greet me and to celebrate the achievement of arriving. And, you know, the communities are getting better. Transportation is now on the agenda, and we are moving forward in Ontario to become more accessible.
Which drives the question. So this was last May that you took on this journey from London to Ottawa. So in that period of time, what progression has the issue made?
Well, here in London, which I can speak the best about because I live it every day, here in London we have more cabs than we've ever had that are wheelchair accessible. We now have accessible cabs from 2 companies rather than just one. Paratransit has had a reinvestment where there's more attention being paid. London also now has buses that have auditory and visual signals for people with visual and hearing impairments. We're getting more accessible. Accessibility is on the agenda here in London and also across the province, where you have Woodstock, who continues to run their fantastic system, Halton Hills, who is looking at a new system, Mississauga, which is looking at a new system. We're definitely taking great strides in the last year, and you know, there's still a ways to go, but we're moving forward, and that's encouraging.
Wonderful. Nicole's going to be at the break, and she's going to have a bit on the human rights case that brought on those audible signals to the buses and that kind of thing. So as you came across the province and you're doing all those speaking engagements and talking this up, was there one general voice that you heard over and over again on that trip?
Well, you know, we heard several voices that would sort of come out continually. We had the voice of the disabled population who were coming out and saying, finally. that this is something that needs to be done, that we need to move forward, that we need to get change going. But we also got a voice from the other side where we had people saying, you know, this is going to be too expensive, it's too difficult, we're not capable of doing this, which is something that really the trip was all about. It was about dispelling those myths and overcoming these archaic perceptions that accessibility is expensive and that it's impossible, because that just isn't the case.
When I do training, I'm actually a trainer on diversity issues. So, and when I do that training on these issues, employers are so surprised when I talk about an average accommodation costing them $80. And they look at me like, really? $80 for an accommodation? And it's like the diverse workforce that's available to those employers by just simply making their places accessible is amazing. What is your experience with that?
Well, this is it. You know, here in Ontario, we have over 1 million people who are identified as being disabled. And of that population, a vast majority of which are on programs like the Ontario Disability Support Program, which has its problems, as I'm sure many of our listeners who are on ODSP know. But at the same time, this is a population that does have a bit of money to spend, and that there is a real niche market here. That if you make your business accessible, not only can you benefit from disabled employees who statistically have the least amount of days off and are the most loyal employees, you can also benefit from this massive population who are looking for places to go. You know, if you're the only shop in town that's accessible, you're going to do pretty good for yourself when you're drawing that. The disabled population.
For sure. And that's the business model for accessibility.
Absolutely. That's the way to move forward, and that's how we're going to get over a lot of the attitudinal barriers that we currently face.
Okay. Well, we have a clip that's coming up, and this is our legal commentary by a London lawyer, Nicole Nussbaum.
My name is Nicole Nussbaum. I'm an employment and human rights lawyer in London, Ontario. And I'm here today to talk about accessibility for people with disability in living in Ontario. According to government estimates, about 15.5% of Ontario's population has some form of disability, and this number will continue to grow as the population ages. As a result, dealing with the issue of accessibility is one that's of vital importance to our province, both economically and personally for people living with disabilities. In 2007, the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal made a decision in the case of Leposky and Toronto Transit Commission. The complainant, Mr. Leposky, who is visually impaired, initiated a human rights complaint against the Toronto Transit Commission with respect to their policy of announcing stops at all of on all of the TTC routes. The TTC had been announcing stops on the subway system, but had not implemented a policy that would announce each stop on the bus service, on all of the bus routes. And the commission found that this was in violation of the TTC's duty to accommodate. As a result, the tribunal ordered the TTC to implement a policy requiring announcement of all stops 100% of the time. In addition to ordering the TTC to provide annual training to its employees regarding the duty to accommodate in terms of disability, the tribunal also ordered the TTC to announce each stop along all of its routes so that people with visual impairment could more easily use the system.
We are all in this together, brothers and sisters.
And welcome back to Between the Margins on 94.9, and we are here in studio with our guest, Jeff Preston, and we just finished a legal brief with Nicole Nussbaum about the human rights case in Toronto. And I believe we all had some lovely comments on that about that over the break, so let's jump back right into it.
Okay, yeah. So you actually saw a presentation with the individual that had that human rights case.
Yeah, David Leposky is a bit of a, he's becoming a leader in the disability rights movement, and he's becoming an individual that people are really getting behind. And on my trip to Ottawa, we were in Toronto when there was a giant forum on accessible transportation, and the TTC asked for opinions from the public to, you know, come in and talk about how accessibility is. And Mr. Leposky was there, and he was the first to make comments and sort of stirred the crowd up. And he got up and he explained how he didn't understand how the TTC goes about saying that it's too expensive, that they don't have the money to become accessible, to add the visual and the auditory announcements, and yet they have spent over almost $500,000 fighting him in court. So where did they get that money? Yet they couldn't do accessibility.
It's always the argument, it seems better to fight than it does to just say, hey, let's do the right thing here.
Exactly. I think there's a problem. The problem right now when we're moving forward and trying to become accessible is that there seems to be a perception that if you become accessible, then the disabled population wins and the non-disabled population in some way loses. And it's this win-loss paradigm that's really, really getting us stuck in the mud and not allowing us to move together as a community to try and solve some of these problems.
As with so many marginalized groups, it seems it's always an us and them scenario. And we're talking about the buses here in the city, and I don't ride the LTC, but obviously you do and others do. And they turn those off sometimes?
Yeah, I've heard from people, friends of mine, who do use the auditory signals, that there have been instances where drivers have turned them off or say that they're not working, perhaps because they're loud, and some say that they're a little annoying. But, you know, this is fundamental to someone's ability to use the service. I don't understand why they think it's okay to turn off the auditory signals, and yet they would never turn off the stairway to get into the bus.
Exactly. And it's awfully annoying when you have to ride around the routes three times trying to find your stop.
Absolutely. Well, I don't have a visual or auditory limitation. However, I find those things incredibly useful. When you're reading on the bus and you don't really know where you are and you hear the auditory signaling, my stop is coming up, time to go. I know it saved me a couple missed stops as well. It's beneficial for everybody.
And usually accommodation for disability usually helps everybody. I mean, everybody likes those ramps when they're moving furniture into a building and
absolutely
everything else, but you would think that it would be an easier sell.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it all comes down to misconception. It comes down to the fact that people just they don't quite understand, because it's not their day-to-day experience. It's not something that they're used to seeing. And if you try and find a codified way to become accessible, there really doesn't exist. Like, we're moving forward in Ontario with the AODA and the standards that are trying to codify what it means to be accessible, what it means to be inclusive. But Ontario is a leader in this. No one else has done it as thoroughly as Ontario is attempting to do, and that makes it very difficult, where it's difficult to learn about how to become accessible.
Right, and when you mentioned the AODA, let's talk about that a little bit.
Absolutely.
So maybe you want to tell us a little bit about what the AODA and the Disability Act, and what is the current legislation that's being implemented?
Sure, absolutely. I'll try and keep it brief. This is something that I'm really interested in, and I've been following it and trying to be an active participant in the process. And so it's something close to my heart. But the AODA, the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, was an act that was passed in 2005, which is actually an upgrade on the ODA, the Ontarians with Disabilities Act. The Ontarians with Disabilities Act was the first act to try and say that we need to get accessible. The problem was that it didn't involve any codified ways or any teeth, as they say. There was no rules about becoming accessible. It was more of a suggestion. The AODA changes that, where not only are we adding in standards, we have five standards that are going to be coming out: customer service, which is already out, information, communication, transportation, employment, and built environment. Not only do we have these standards, but we also are having compliance measures on the Ontario government, which says if you don't follow these standards, if you don't become inclusive, then there are going to be penalties. So no longer is it cheaper to stay inaccessible. It will now be probably more expensive if you break the accessibility law.
And right now we're on the informational side of the accessibility, and there's certain criteria that have to be met by January 1st, 2010.
Yes, for public, for nonprofit, or sorry, government nonprofits. Nonprofits are lumped in with the businesses. So right now we have government organizations and public organizations. They must comply to customer service by January 1st of this year, or 2010. Private business doesn't have to comply until 2013.
Right, and the University of Western Ontario is one of those that has to comply.
Absolutely.
So I was at a public information meeting there where they were telling us all about the wonderful, great things that they are doing to help the disabled community here at Western. Do you have any experience with that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I first decided to come to university, or rather come to Western, I was in about grade 11, and I'd been going around to my family to universities, checking them out, looking to see how the accessibility is and meeting with people. And it was really the services for students with disabilities here at Western that drew me in. And they said, you know, we're an old campus. There are buildings that aren't accessible, but we're committed to fixing that, and we're committed to helping you to have the same opportunity as everybody else. And they really have. Whenever I've had an issue, I bring it forward, and one way or another, that situation gets resolved. The administration here at Western, the staff here at Western, genuinely aren't committed to becoming more accessible, and they've shown it through the development of accessible committees, like the CARE Committee. They've done it through the accessible transit system, which is completely renovated and the first in that I've ever seen at a university. They're definitely making strides forward, and I have no problem saying when I go to other universities, when I go across Ontario and across Canada and the United States, that the University of Western Ontario is the most accessible university that I've ever been to.
Great. And when I... as our producer sneezes in her headsets and distracts us, she's in total entertainment piece back there.
Sorry, folks.
Where was it? Oh, yes, accessibility in Western. I know some of the buildings that I go into, and myself being a disabled person, one of the invisible disabled people, because people tend to look at me and say, oh, you're not disabled. You know, and I put out my handicap parking permit and people accost me, which is a great thing. And I'd rather them challenge people about that than not, seeing how there seems to be this, I don't know, this environment here at Western where the able-bodied people seem to find our disabled parking spots just free open parking.
Actually, we had a good example of that today. We pulled into one of the handicapped parking spaces, and there was a gentleman in the handicapped space next to us. And as we got out of the vehicle, Michelle calls over to them. She said, she looked and didn't see the parking permit. She said, oh, are you handicapped? And he said, yeah. And then he just walked off.
Afterwards, we take a look at his car, and he has no permit. And it's... I just can't understand how people are so inconsiderate to the disabled community.
Yeah, you know, case in point, today is one of the first times this year that I've been able to find a wheelchair parking spot here at the UCC. And they have a ton of wheelchair parking in Social Side parking lot, and they're normally full, unfortunately. And it does really go both ways, where I find you have a lot of people who go into the parking spot, they say, you know, I'm just going to be a second, I won't be long. It's just running in and out. And so, you know, that's not the point. But at the same time, I have had instances as well where I've pulled into the wheelchair parking, and my aide gets out to lower the ramp, and somebody drives by and gives them an earful for parking in the wheelchair parking spot, and then the lift slowly lowers out of the van, and their face goes red, and they speed off, and they don't want to. They feel really embarrassed, but at Western especially, that people do seem to park in the wheelchair spots quite a bit. And what I always do is, if I ever see a car that's not in that doesn't have a permit, that's in the wheelchair parking, I always give a little call over to parking services, because I'm sure if the person really wants to park there, you know, that's fine by me, but they're gonna need to pay a couple hundred dollars to park there.
And we've got an interview later. We had a call earlier with Chris Bumbaco, the manager of parking services, and he talks more about those parking spots and what they're doing about these problems. So with Western, and can you talk more about, you said that there's a transit system within Western?
Yeah. When I arrived here many, many moons ago, aging myself here, when I arrived here in 2002, Western had a transportation system to get people from with disabilities, primarily physical disabilities, from their residence to campus for class. And it was a service that was being run, piggybacking on another company's service in London, not through paratransit, but privately. And the service was in disarray when I arrived. And vehicles would essentially come and they would either not get you at all, or they would come and get you, they'd drop you off, and then they wouldn't return to bring you home. So constantly I was left walking through the snow, through the rain, getting to and from class. In fact, 1 week where I attempted to exclusively use the transit system to make it to my classes, I only made it to 1 hour of class. The rest of the rides were missing, forgotten, or were too late to get me to class in time. So I started advocating to Western, and over several years, they developed a new system where they now have buses that remain on campus all day that are available from 7 until 10 to get people to and from class, direct booking, no more early booking. You have to call several days in advance. It's, if you want to go somewhere, you can call. If there's a ride available, great. And usually there is. The drivers are great at moving things around to make sure everyone gets the service that they need, and people aren't getting left behind anymore.
That's a wonderful service, and it's great that the university has taken that on. As we know with the paratransit system, it's not always that accommodating to the people that it accommodates. So we're going to go to break now, and we're going to be back in a couple of minutes with Jeff Preston, our guest, and Michelle Boyce and Gio Lakey. Welcome back to Between the Margins on CHRW. I guess I better get that right. Just to let you know, we do have a website if you want more information on our shows, and we also have podcasting and archives that will be up there of each show, and the website is www.betweenthemargins.ca.
And we will also be providing links to Jeff's documentary, Idling, A Transit Story, that will be available there as well.
Great. So what we have earlier, I spoke to Perry Ferguson, who's the president of Voyageur, and we have that clip now. Curious if you could do a couple of things. If you could tell me what services that you provide for the disability community, and also any extra services that you might be making available if there is a transit strike in the city.
We provide, we operate the paratransit on behalf of the LTC, which isn't part of this this group that's looking to go on strike. And so I don't see any changes with this, that service at all, if there's the possibility of a strike. As far as other services, I think that, you know, we're in the vehicle for hire business, and you know, that'll affect that. There'll be obviously people looking for taxis and limousines to get around town because they can't get the bus. So I expect that we'll be busier in that particular area. So.
Right. And how many vehicles do you have presently that accommodate people with disabilities?
Well, we have well over 80, but I mean, there's about 25 of them that work for the LTC.
And you don't expect any problems with the paratransit system staying in place if the LTC goes on strike?
No, I don't see any. It's separate from the transit side of it, so it's we're completely separate from them. So I don't see any changes in that. I'm sure that they don't want to disrupt that service anyways.
That's wonderful news, and there's a lot of people that'll be glad to hear that. With the paratransit system, all of the bookings and all of that are done through LTC, though, are they not?
That's correct.
So they just basically contract you, and then you provide the vehicles and go where they tell you to? Is that basically how the system works?
That's absolutely true, yes.
So you also operate the Checker cabs.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Does Checker provide accessible vehicles?
No, we do that through the Voyager part of our business, but Checker does not, no.
And Voyager, we see the Voyager vans at all of our schools and everywhere else providing transportation services through that medium. Do you also provide a call-in service where people can call and get vehicles?
Yes, both for Checker and for our people that require accessible vans.
Okay, so if somebody calls in the Checker line and wants an accessible vehicle, then that would be provided by Voyager, but they could get that service on that line?
That's correct.
Okay, great. I really appreciate your comments, and thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
So that brings us up to our accessibility and talking about the LTC and paratransit section of the show. And there's challenges there, and there's things that are working well. Generally, when you talk about the two, the LTC and the paratransit systems, how are your feelings generally about those?
More or less, I guess the best way to sum it up would be that the paratransit system is broken. It does not service the population. And I believe that in many ways, it's really contributing to the reinstitutionalization of people with disabilities in this city.
Well, that's a strong statement. Looking through their website and the information that they had on paratransit, I was shocked and awed at some of what I read there. Things like you have to book 3 days in advance, and the waiting on the phone piece, and the fact that they don't have internet booking. What do they need to do to that service to make it more accessible?
Honestly, tear it to the ground and let's start again. The problem with the paratransit system is the foundation. And in the same way that you wouldn't build a house on a bad foundation, we cannot build a paratransit system on a bad foundation. Paratransit is stymied by rules like the 3-day booking. It's problematic by the way the bookings are done. There aren't enough buses. So people are left on the bus sometimes for over an hour driving around the city waiting for their ride or for their drop-off to come up. This doesn't work. The way to do it, personally, from my humblest opinion, is that we need to start looking at some private options. We need to look at some more private opportunity. We need to deregulate it a little bit. The rules are the problem. And there are ways to move forward on that. And places like Woodstock are doing it with subsidized cab rides. That system works. People are getting the door-to-door service they need. Another way to help paratransit is by getting more accessible buses so that people who don't need the door-to-door service can then use buses. That's going to take some of the weight off the paratransit service so that the rides are available for those who need it.
Now, I noticed in your documentary that you were talking about some of the accessible buses and the fact that it's a grandfathered system. Could you go into a little bit of detail about that?
Yeah, as far as I can understand it, and from what I've been told by the LTC, so if I misrepresent them, I apologize, but from my understanding, the plan is that as old buses break down, new ones are going to be brought in, and those are guaranteed to be accessible. It's a plan that I believe is supposed to take about 10 years, they expect. Again, that's just what I've heard and what I've been told.
And just how many of the main routes are on with accessible buses?
Oh, very, very few. Very few. I live downtown, and I can tell you right now that the 2 Dundas is very, very rarely accessible. 13 Wellington is very rarely accessible. It is nearly impossible for me to get to either Masonville or White Oaks Mall consistently on the bus.
Wow. And I have to ask, do you think that part of the problem with a broken system is that we have a large number of able-bodied people who say this looks really good on paper, this looks really good in theory, but in practicality, they just don't have the experience to know what is needed?
I think that's exactly it. I've been trying to put out a challenge, and I'm going to put out a challenge right now on the radio, that I challenge every city councilor, including Mayor Anne-Marie DeCicco, Best, to try and live a week on paratransit. Try and ride paratransit for 1 week. Try and get to your job. Try and get to your home. Try and socialize. And if you use that service for a week and you see what it's like, I think we'll get some real good change.
probably would. There was a point in time that I picked a fight with a car and I lost, and I ended up in downtown Toronto riding their public transit system with crutches and a cane, and I can tell you it was 1 week that opened my eyes.
It's always a challenge, because when you get off the bus, if you can get off the bus, then how is the city accessible around the bus stops and that kind of thing, and how does that work within the city?
Exactly. That's another huge issue, where you have certain stops that aren't accessible, where you can't, once you get out of the bus, you're not able to get off the curb. There are no curb cuts. But more than that are the snow removal policies here in London, in that snow is not removed, meaning that if you do have the luck to get onto the bus at an area where there isn't a giant snowbank to let the ramp down, you might not get off that bus again. And if you do, there's no guarantee you're going to be able to get on the sidewalk because it's covered in snow, which essentially means the service is completely inaccessible during the winter months.
Wow. I could not imagine having to live in a manner that these things dictated where you could go and what you could do. To that extent, I mean, even as we were doing research for this show, we were examining other cultures across the world, and there were some clips from a gentleman in Russia, actually, who said that some buildings are made accessible so that the people can't even leave their own homes, that they have to have everything done in their homes because there's no way for them to physically get out of the building.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the problem. And this is the concern. This is my concern, is that the system is developing rules. It's changing the way that we live our lives. It's dictating how we live our lives. And I think if you were to go to somebody, a Western student, and you were to say, how would you feel about a transit system that you have to get up at 7 a.m. every morning to book 3 days in advance, and a system that if you cancel the day of because you're sick or you're hungover and don't want to go to class, how would you feel if you got a letter in the mail because you canceled less than 24 hours and were blamed, essentially? We're blamed for being the problem. The system doesn't work, that it's your fault. It's not the LTC. It's not their bizarro rules and regulations. It's your fault because you canceled a ride for completely legitimate reasons.
So putting it back on the marginalized.
Exactly. It's always our fault. Always blame the guy in a wheelchair because he can't catch you.
Okay, that definitely leaves it having to be asked, what was your worst transportation experience?
My worst transportation experience. Well, London has had some doozies. I was left at the cinema once. I went to a movie. I was told I had a ride home. Ride didn't arrive. I ended up walking home at about 4 in the morning, and it was cold. It was late November, and I froze. And I remember I was coming up to Perth Hall. I was living in Perth Hall at the time, and I was coming down Western Road, and I could see Perth Hall in the distance. And, my eyes were burning and watering, so it was so cold. I couldn't feel my hands. I had class the next day, and I remember thinking, never again. Never again am I going to do this. But then when you line it up, then you have two choices. You either drive yourself to the cold, meaning you are doing it again, or you don't leave your home. And that's something that my parents were always very strict about. And they said, Jeff, you're not going to live this isolated life. You're not going to be stuck in your home. You're going to do what you want to do. You're going to get out there just like everybody else. And I refused to sit idly by. And that's why I've been fighting as hard as I have been to try and open it up, not just for myself, but for all the other people in this city and in Ontario and in Canada who are doing just that. They're left stuck in the system and they don't know how to get out. And they say, well, I give up then, and I'm just going to sit at home. And that's not right. And those are the people that I'm fighting for.
Wonderful. Okay. So we're going to go to a quick break here and lighten it up a little bit. We've got some comedy with Josh Blue, the comedian, who's a disabled comedian. So we'll be back in 2 minutes.
Me.
This is what it's like
to be me.
This is what it's like to be me.
Josh, everybody loves you, obviously. So what inspired you to do stand-up, of all things?
I don't think I had a choice, really. What am I going to do? Be a traffic cop? People ask me if I get nervous before coming up on stage. I said, heck no, I got this many people staring at me all day. I was walking downtown, and the drunk tank stopped and picked me up. I was like, uh-oh. I was like, wait a minute here, fellas, there's a misunderstanding. I'm not drunk, I have cerebral palsy. They were like, that's a pretty big word for a drunk. I was in there for 7 days. They're like, damn, buddy, what did you drink? Man, I wanted to go to this global warming rally last week, but it was just too hot. I knew it was too hot because some dude comes up to me and goes, hey, hot enough for you? I looked him up and down. I was like, yeah, you're pretty cute. I just don't roll that way. Make fun of yourself before someone else can, and then they do it, they look really dumb. My friend Jenny's back here, and she coined the phrase reverse teasing. It's like, I'm making fun of me, I'm making fun of you, I'm making fun of me again. And somehow Cripple comes out on top. Whoever put this brain into this body made the perfect match. Fortunately, I have cerebral palsy, and if there's a cure, I wouldn't do it. Just because this is who I am. This is my life.
And we're back with Between the Margins here on 94.9 CHRW. And the gentleman you just heard was an incredible comedian by the name of Josh Blue. And not only is he amazing in his stand-up, but he was also the winner of the 4th Last Comic Standing competition. So that's quite an achievement. Anyway, when we were on the break, you were telling us a wonderful story about transportation in Boston. Please enlighten us.
Yes. The good news here is that transportation is not just a problem in Ontario or in Canada, but this is something that spans the globe. A few years ago, I was in Boston for, ironically, an academic conference, and I had to get a cab to get to the place that I was speaking at, and so I called a cab, and this very rickety, which can only be described as barely street legal van pulls up, and we ask the guy, are you sure this is safe? Like, is this a safe vehicle? And he said, oh, yes, very safe. So I said, okay, so let's get in. So he pops the trunk open, and he pulls out these two pieces of plywood, and he lays them down. He's like, this is my ramp. And I'm like, that's plywood, man. That's not a ramp. And he said, no, it's safe. And I look, and there's a big seat in the back of the van. And he says, I say, you know, I'm not going to be able to fit in here. There's a seat in the way. He's like, oh, no, I fold it up. So he folds the seat up, and he literally sits it on the seat directly in front of it. And I pull in, and I say, you know, are there straps to tie me down? And he's like, why would I tie you down? And I was like, well, it's a moving vehicle. It's seatbelts, nothing. Okay. So he's like, now, he's like, I have to ask you a favor. I need you to hold the seat in front of you. Otherwise, it will fall on you as we're driving. I sort of smile. I'm like, oh, you know, it's really funny. So you're going to, like, tie it down? He's like, no, seriously, you have to hold the seat. So we're driving, and I'm bracing this chair with, like, I can only lift about a pound. So very meager. And all I see is a seat rocking back and forth, like, getting closer and closer to me. And I'm like, this is going to fall on my legs. And so I sort of signal to my aide, and I'm like, help, like, this thing's going to fall and break my legs. And he turns to me, he's like, Jeff, you don't walk, you don't need them anyway, don't worry about it. And so sure enough, we arrived safe and sound, and the seat did not fall. It was very close, and I asked the driver if I got a discount for doing part of the job, holding the chair, and he said no, full fare, and whizzed off in his rickety rust bucket.
Wow. Unbelievable what people expect us to go through in this world to get around.
And pay for it, too.
And pay for it, too.
It's quite
for
that privilege.
I know. It's like Wonderland or something. It's like Wonderland Boston.
Hey, look, Ma, no hands.
No legs, either.
Well, back to that parking issue, and we've got a clip here where I caught up with Chris Quimbarco, the manager of parking services, earlier on this week.
Chris.
What I would like is if you could explain how to get accessible parking permits. I'm kind of confused by the website on how it is that someone goes about the process of parking in handicap parking spots within the university.
There's basically an application form, much like any person would apply for a parking permit. Are you talking about a person who would be here permanently or just a visitor? I guess I should qualify my question.
Both, actually. Is there a different procedure for a visitor versus someone who's regularly coming to the university?
A visitor would be using one of the visitor lots, typically, because they wouldn't have an actual long-term parking permit. So a visitor would use a visitor lot, and at all of our visitor lots, whether they be metered or pay and display or attended, there are barrier-free parking spaces. And so the visitor would use one of the barrier-free parking spaces. They're set aside for that, for their use only.
Okay, and they wouldn't need any additional paperwork from
No, they would just have their ministry-issued permit.
Okay.
On the vehicle.
And if you're a student and you have accessible, or
if
you have a parking pass?
If you're a student and you have a parking pass, what you would do, or faculty or staff, what you would do is you would apply for a permit like any other faculty staff, and within the different lots, there are also barrier-free designated parking spaces. And then it depends on the nature of the disability. If it's a situation where you actually need to be even closer, we can also set up temporary spaces even closer or designate one of the space in the visitor lot that might be closer to your building than whatever space.
That's great. And I understand that the university is the same as the City of London, whereby you don't put money in meters if you're disabled?
Correct.
Now, I'm at the university a lot, and I actually do have my own visitor or my own handicap parking permit. And
right.
And I find that it's very difficult to get an open spot, and they seem to be filled with vehicles that don't have handicap permits.
Okay. Then if you happen to notice that, we do have enforcement teams that go out. Unfortunately, there's only depending on the time of day, there could be only one enforcement team out, or up to two enforcement teams that cover the entire campus. What they do is go through the entire campus, and so there's no, we ticket where we can, and we do actually ticket a number of people every day for parking in the handicapped spaces.
Oh, I know you do. And is there a number that people can call if they do notice somebody parked where they're not supposed to be parked?
Oh, just our main parking office.
And what's
just
that number?
Our main parking services number. They would 519-661-2111, extension 883973. If you want to just dial direct, it's 519-661-3973, as opposed to going through the main university switchboard.
And it's a fairly severe fine if you're actually caught parked into one of those spots without a permit.
Yes,
is it
not? It is. $150. And I do know that our parking appeals committee does not waive too many of those. The use of I didn't know or I was just going to be in for 2-3 minutes. The parking appeals committee treats the barrier-free parking and the fire routes very strictly. And the parking appeals committee, there's no members of it on parking services. The voting members are all members of the university community, so different representatives from faculty, staff, students, both undergraduate and graduate students are the people who actually sit on that committee. And there's no actual voting members from parking to make it impartial. And, I can tell you that they take the barrier-free parking nor the fire roads. They take those very seriously.
That's good to hear, because hopefully when people hear this radio show, they're going to actually figure out that maybe they shouldn't be parking in those spots.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Well, thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to add about?
Sure. Well, there's one other thing that we do. It's not that, and this is what may cause some of the confusion. We also recognize that from time to time there are people who may require to use the barrier-free spots on a short-term basis after an injury that incapacitates them for a short period of time or a surgery or something like that, and it may not be enough to qualify them for the MTO. Like I believe there's a 2 or 3 month. If I'm not mistaken, I think it's in order to qualify for one of the MTO barrier-free passes, you need something it needs to be something that's going to be longer than a month or two, or because they won't issue a whole new parking plate for that. But we do have a Center for Students with Disabilities on campus, and if someone goes to either the Center for Students with Disabilities on campus and they're certified by that group or through our rehabilitation services for us faculty, staff, and employees, based on those two organizations, we can issue temporary barrier-free permits as well. So if you happen to have a faculty or staff member who's had knee surgery and therefore is having mobility problems but is expected to recover within a few weeks, and we can make those accommodations as well, so they don't have to actually get a full-fledged
permit. Service.
But it is not something that we do at the counter, and that's the one thing that I just want to make sure everybody understands that, because we're not qualified to judge at the parking counter, you know, whether someone can do that, but that's something that, you know, our rehab services for, you know, faculty and staff, and then the Center for Students with Disabilities for students are able to do that. It just makes it a bit more convenient, because we do know that, you know, hey, things happen.
That for sure. And how do they get more information on that if they need that service?
Usually they would call us and ask us, you know, do you have, you know, say I've just had knee surgery, or I'm on the soccer team and I, you know, twisted my knee or whatever it might be. And they, you know, they may call us and say, what can I do? And then that's when we would refer them, depending on if they're a student, we refer them to the Center for Students with Disabilities. And if they're a faculty or staff, we refer them to the rehab services. And usually it happens very, very quickly. Within a day or two, they can quickly get an appointment. And then we just get, you know, confirmation that that's okay, and we can issue them a temporary permit. And sometimes it's, you know, it may be a temporary permit up until the point that they, you know, they get their full-fledged permit from the ministry. And so this way they're not, you know, kind of stuck in that no man's land in the middle where they're still waiting for one.
Well, life does create enough no man's lands for people with disabilities. So
yes,
it's appreciated that you guys down there are doing everything you can to make that life better for everyone.
Well, we try. That's the thing. We try and we do what we can with the space that we have. And we do monitor the lots, that if there are, we can never tell from, you know, year to year exactly how many spaces are needed near certain buildings, but we do, and we, for example, in the building that I'm in right now, one of the support services building, we did designate a couple of extra spaces based on the fact that there were a few people in a visitor lot that's right near the building, based on the fact that a couple of employees were taking up the visitor spaces because they need to be close to the building, and so we designated a few spaces for them. You know, I took them out of the other spaces. So you have to have that flexibility, I guess, is the thing, to be able to make more when you need them. And, you know, same is true with classrooms.
One of the things that I have noticed as a regular visitor to campus, because I'm not a regular faculty or student there, is that the parking lot at the UCC that's usually got access, sometimes that's a closed lot for events or whatever. And that puts anybody visiting the UCC in a pretty big bind as far as accessible parking, because there aren't any signed parking that are very close to the UCC except for that lot.
Yeah, probably the next closest would be the Kent Drive lot.
Right, and that's
coming from the other direction. Right.
Okay, wonderful. Well, that's great to talk to you, and thank you very much for your insight on that. And it clears up a lot of my confusion as a visitor to campus, and hopefully it clears up a lot of other people's as well.
Okay, well, good luck to you then.
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, bye.
And welcome back to Between the Margins. We're out of time with the show. We did want to dedicate this show with the passing of Jesse Davidson. So we wanted to dedicate this show to the memory of the Jesse's journey. And there is a memorial service to be held on Tuesday, November 10th at St. Paul's Cathedral at 472 Richmond Street at 10 a.m. for those that want to pay their respects. So that's our show for today. And thank you very much, Jeff.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, you guys, for having me.
It was a pleasure.
And remember, our website is www.betweenthemargins.ca. Thanks.
So many things. Because the way it's set in your mind affects yourself and affects the way people think about you.
You have been listening to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9. Special thanks to Carrie Simmons, our producer, and Jeff Preston and all our guests today. Next week, Epworth will be back, and in 2 weeks' time, we'll be back with our show on HIV Awareness Week. This is Gio Lakey and Michelle Boyce. Have a great day.